Just go around and let each person introduce himself or herself and have an initial familiarity with each other and an initial notion perhaps of what program you're in and that sort of thing. So I'm Bob Doran, professor of systematic theology at Regis College since 1979, and I'm director of the Lonely Research Institute, which is, I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. It's sort of right across the street in 10 St. Mary Street, Suite 500. So we'll start with Shandor.
My name is Shandor, and I'm a Regis student. I'm about to finish my MD program and begin my THM.
Frank Raffinelli, professor at St. Augustine Seminary.
I'm Vernon from Regis College, doing my THM.
Mark Robson, I'm registered here at Regis, first year of the THM.
I'm Nadia, I'm in my final year in MDiv program.
I'm Brian Pham, I'm a Regis student, and I'm in my final year at the MDiv.
Sheldon Davis, second year MTS at Regis.
I'm Craig Lozon. I work at the Lonergan Research Institute, and part of my job is to tape this course. So, behave yourselves.
My name is Dorothy Cummings, and I'm in my second year of my MDiv at Regis.
My name is Sean Michelson, and I'm in my first year of the MDiv here at Regis.
John Nadowski, I'm a professor here at Regis and a perpetual student.
I'm Chris Jacobs Vandegeer, and I'm beginning the doctoral program here at Regis.
I am Robbie from Regis College, second year MDiv.
Jeff Allen, St. Mike's, MA.
Okay. Thank you. I remember John was in the course the first semester here, I think, weren't you? Okay, with regard to the books, the book is Lonergan's Insight, and I want to use the Collected Works edition because, well, we should have a standard edition that we're all using because of pagination and so forth. But this is also the closest to a critical edition of the book that we're going to have for a while, at least. When we did the editing of this, we discovered 130 items in the course of the book that needed to be changed by reading the original manuscript against two typescripts. So there are some changes, some of which are not very important, but some of which are like to change fraction to function, changes the meaning of a sentence. It had been misread as fraction and the word was function. And that's one that stands out in my mind. The book has been ordered at Anglican Book Center, and if you buy it at Anglican Book Center and identify yourself as being in this course, you will get a 20% discount. It's a $35 book and a soft cover. You can't get the hardcover. Also, if you identify yourselves as at the Anglican Book Center, you probably know this already, as students in TST, you get a 10% discount across the board over there. But if you identify yourself as buying this book for a course, it's 20%. Greg mentioned what he's going to be doing here. It has been thought that we should have a record in the archives of at least one course taught on Insight. And Greg is the audio archivist at the Lonergan Research Institute. His principal job is to take tapes, cassette and reel tapes of Lonergan. We have over 500 hours of cassette and reel tapes of Lonergan's work, and to transfer those to CD-ROM, to CD audio, and to clean up the sound as he's doing that. But he's also been recording other Lonergan events, both here and in Boston, and there was a desire that we have a record of a course. One of the things that Greg is going to make available to any of you who want it is the following. In 1958, Lonergan gave a two-week series of lectures on his own book, Insight. And that series of lectures has become the book, Understanding and Being, which is volume 5 in the Collected Works of Lonergan. And Greg is currently transferring the tapes of those lectures to CD-ROM, but he's also making them into MP3s for this class, for anyone in this class who wishes them. So there will probably be four CDs when it's all done. One will be available by a week from now, which contains about the first third of Lonergan's lectures on Insight. And any one of you who wants that CD may have it for $10. So if you let Greg know that you'd like to listen, you'd like to be able to listen to Lonergan talking about his own book, it's quite an experience. I mean, it really is an educational experience that is not available in many other areas. And you can pick that up. Just let Greg know how many. I mean, I suppose maybe by the end of today, if it's possible, we would have at least an indication of how many we should have ready for next week. It is quite something to listen to him talking about the book that he just published a year before.
If I could know by, say, Monday or Tuesday, because that's probably when I'll start burning the discs. Middle of next week, the latest. I'll wait till, say, Tuesday. I'll say Tuesday. By Tuesday, I'm going to start burning the discs. So if anyone wants one, if you could let us know by that time.
That's great. I would recommend it. I think it will really help your reading of this to listen to him talk about it, rather than just the other. It's the first time that I've had the chance to actually use this as part of the teaching. The clarity of sound is superb, it's sometimes you have a sense that you're right there and speaking in the room to you. Okay, my office is at 10 St. Mary Street in the Lonergan Research Institute, Suite 500. My phone number is 416-922-2433. 922-2433. I'm there. I'm probably more than I should be, but you can reach me there at any time. My email is bdorenca@yahoo.ca. And by having a Yahoo email, I've avoided about 1,000 viruses in the last month. Because Yahoo screens and scan very well. But it's bdorenca@yahoo.ca. The Lonergan Research Library, the library in the Institute, is open Monday to Friday from 9 to 5. It's the most complete library in the world of Lonergan-related materials. All of the original writings, a number of the transcripts of lectures that have not yet been published, and any secondary materials that we've been able to discover, books, articles, dissertations, master's theses, are there. And so if you're interested in a particular topic, there's the card catalog is divided into three categories, by author, by title, and by subject. So for instance, you might be interested in the topic of conversion in one of those writings, you can find you can look in the card catalog or on the computer in the library under the topic conversion and find entries for that. And then Michael Shields, Father Michael Shields, is the librarian and he will be very happy to help you find your way around the library. It takes a little bit of getting used to it. The numbering system is not the same as Regis. It's a system that is proper to our small institute. Once you get the hang of it, it's pretty easy to find your way around because it is a small research library, highly specialized. I've also put a number of books on the reserve shelf at Regis, practically everything that Lonergan's published, and a couple of secondary materials, so I do have a fairly extensive reserve shelf at Regis as well. Okay, one other point of announcement. If you get interested in further things in Lonergan, the Lonergan Research Institute sponsors 5 seminars a year held at Regis College. This year they'll be held in the new classroom E, which is right upstairs out here. And the first two are scheduled already for Thursday, October the 9th, right after this class. They will be on Thursday afternoons at 4:15. John Dadosky will be the presenter in the first seminar, and it's on Navajo contributions to the theology of beauty. And the respondent, I believe, is a person by the name of David Lipte, who is a former student in the philosophy department at the University of Toronto. Mike Burton is going to try to ask David to respond to it. The second is on Thursday, November the 13th. Danny Mansour, who works at the Lonergan Research Institute, will present on special and general categories in theology. And I will be responding to him at that. Students as well are welcome to present, and I've already buttonholed a couple of students and asked them to think about presenting in the second term, presenting a paper, presenting a chapter of a thesis, presenting something that they're working on. It's a good opportunity for dialogue, and it's been going since 1985, ongoing seminar. All right, that's it. That's it as far as the introductory material is concerned. And then we launch into it. When I say that's it, that doesn't mean I'm sending you home. I'm going to give you a copy. I composed the introductory lecture, and rather than have you furiously trying to take notes, I copied it out for you. And so you can follow it. I'm not just going to read it to you, but you may follow it along and stop me at any point and raise questions for clarification. In general, the way that I found appropriate for teaching these major texts like Insight and Method and Theology is to present rather thorough notes for each class, and we use the notes as the basis for the class. So I'll be doing this all semester. It won't be like this, a lecture. It'll be a point thing from here on. Taking a number of points from the reading for the week for the book. That way you can follow and you can underline, and but you don't have to spend half your energy writing notes. You can follow along that way, and it seems to work. If we find as we go along that you want a different system, I'm looking to a different system, but this one has worked from the time that I started doing it. I haven't done this before. I've actually given out a full lecture. But I just figured that it's a much easier way to. Cora, would you like to introduce yourself first before we run around before you came in? So,
yes, I'm Cora. I'm Cora Tuchman-Mona. And I was introduced to Lonergan's thought by Bob Dorn in 1986. And I've had a wonderful and long history continued on in Lonergan's thought, and did my doctoral dissertation with Bob on Lonergan's notion of dialectic and what I called then feminist consciousness. And I have the opportunity to be in Toronto right now, and I'm here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so I was searching around for a way to start the course, and I've started it in different ways each time that I've taught it. And I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take as the starting point a sentence from the preface, which we'll be reading in the course of the next week, a sentence which appears on page 7 of the preface to Insight. My aim was to seek a common ground on which people of intelligence might meet. Very strong statement to make at the beginning of a major philosophical work. My aim was to seek a common ground on which people of intelligence might meet. There's a praxis orientation from the very beginning, in other words, that this is going to be a very serious philosophical work. It's in the tradition of Aristotle, of Aquinas. It's an attempt to take seriously the issues raised by Kant and Hegel, but it's also got a dimension that is inspired by perhaps an attempt to provide some kind of an alternative to the praxis notions of liberalism and Marxism that were the principal political philosophies at the time that Lonergan was writing the book. And perhaps we can place that statement, my aim was to seek a common ground on which people of intelligence might meet, into the context that he provides in a longer passage at the end of chapter 16, page 552 in this edition. This is very strong statement as well, as there is a post-Cartesian affirmation of philosophy that rules theology out of court, so there is a post-Kantian affirmation of science that tosses overboard even Kant's modest claims for philosophy. And there is a still later totalitarian violence that with equal impartiality brushes aside theology and philosophy and science. But at that empty conclusion to the sequence of ever less comprehensive syntheses, man still exists. You'll have to get used to the fact that he did most of his writing before he became sensitive to the issue of exclusive language. At the empty conclusion to the sequence of ever less comprehensive syntheses, man still exists, and man still is called upon to decide. Archaists urge him to imagine that he lives in an age of liberalism or rationalism or faith. Futurists paint for him a utopia that cannot disguise its own mythical features. But the plain fact is that the world lies in pieces before him and pleads to be put together again. To be put together not as it stood before, on the careless foundation of assumptions that happened to be unquestioned, but on the strong ground of the possibility of questioning, and with full awareness of the range of possible answers. So, common to both of those statements is the word ground, a common ground on which people of intelligence might meet, and the strong ground of the possibility of questioning. And one ground is the other. The common ground on which we might meet is by identity the strong ground of the possibility of questioning. And that is what is uncovered in this book. The ground of the possibility of questioning and the very structure of the questions that we raise. The structure that relates to one another, the different kinds of questions that we raise. The urgency of uncovering that ground appears in the second statement, the world lies in pieces before us. But it's not at all absent from the preface, as you'll see when you read that in the next week. And what Lonergan could not have known while he was writing this book in search of a ground is how much more desperate is the exigence for such an open space for dialogue now than even then 50 years ago. The world lies in pieces before us, both intellectually and physically. Intellectually, the fragmentation of knowledge has grown only more acute. And there are those who will tell us that there is no ground at all, that this is the way it is. These are called anti-foundationalists. And one of the major questions in this course when reading Lonergan today, in any contemporary reading of Lonergan, is whether his clear affirmation of a foundational reality and of an articulation of that reality in what he calls foundations, whether that is subject to the critique of the anti-foundationists. I don't believe it is, and I will try to give some reasons in the course of the year why I don't think it is, but it's a major question that has to be faced. Certainly, when the possibility of independent inquiry and open communication, the possibility of questioning, is stifled, the seeds of totalitarianism or of some other form of nihilism have already been sown. And then the world will lie in pieces before us, not only intellectually, but also physically and materially, like the collapsed towers in New York precisely 2 years ago today. And it may be that Lonergan means by foundational reality simply the possibility of independent inquiry and open communication. And by foundations, the articulation of that possibility. I think that's what he means by both of those. Foundational reality is the possibility innate to us of independent inquiry and open communication. And foundations is the articulation of that possibility. And I think that's a major issue involved in any 2003-2004 reading of this book, if we were going to read it in the contemporary intellectual context of both philosophy and I once wrote about 10 years ago that there is emerging a new period of Lonergan studies where the major themes are community, dialogue, otherness, mediation, plurality. Some characteristics of Lonergan's early writings made some people regard him as only remotely concerned about such themes, perhaps intellectually concerned, but not existentially so. But that, I think, is a misreading. To state up front in a preface to a major work in philosophy, to a work that in effect attempts to redraw the map of the discipline, and in my estimation largely succeeds in doing so, to state that one is seeking a common ground on which people can meet is to evince a concern for these themes, for community, dialogue, otherness, mediation, morality. And a concern that is more than simply intellectual. Okay. However this might be, these two statements express at least something of what insight is all about, and yet we can't leave it there, because to leave it there could easily create the impression that the book is simply reactive, attempting, however profoundly and compassionately, to heal the effects of a crisis, but basically involved only in a kind of intellectual palliative care for a small community already convinced that civilization is over, seeking an enclave of peace and rationality while awaiting some apocalyptic conclusion. Lonergan did not exclude the possibility of an apocalypse, but he did not leave it there. He once wrote a wonderful short lecture entitled Healing and Creating in History that appears in the book A Third Collection, which is on the reserve shelf. And he made the point in that lecture that healing without creating is like a soul without a body. The fact is that the crisis that affects us is at its roots a crisis of meaning, and as such it is a function of the fact that something very new is emerging. That crisis of meaning theme is even more pronounced today if in fact we are involved in the clash of civilizations. Very well in the case. The discovery of the common ground, of the strong ground, would also be the uncovering of the possibility of a new stage or plateau in what Lonergan calls in several places the intellectual control of meaning. So I'm going to put a number of things here. Firstly, the common ground. The common ground is the strong ground. The possibility of questioning. Those now are the ground of a stage in the evolution of meaning. A couple of letters before we're done. The word, when I mentioned here the intellectual control of meaning, the word control has to be understood as he intended it. It doesn't mean some sort of totalitarian or bureaucratic or, God help us, ecclesiastical suppression of questions and answers, but rather a self-possessed intellectual and existential monitoring of just what is going forward in our time. So what is going forward in our time? Well, that's a hard question to answer. Contemporaries in general do not know. They don't know. They experience it, but they don't know it. What's going forward? Historians are far better at telling us what was going forward in previous times than contemporaries are in stating just what is going forward in their own time. It's too complicated for us to get a hold of. Historians have not only historical experience, but also historical knowledge. And their historical knowledge, however tentative it may be, is far greater than that of contemporaries about their own time. We have a great deal of historical experience, but not much historical knowledge about our own time. And still we can ask just what our historical experience is. And Lonergan makes a contribution to answering that question. And it's in terms of this new stage in the evolution of meaning. The method in theology, there's talk of a third stage of meaning. The notion of stages of meaning is a model or an ideal type. And a model or ideal type is not something that describes reality. It's a mental construction that it might be helpful to have around when one is describing reality. Might or might not be helpful. And It's not meant to be a description of reality. It's meant to be some kind of mental construction that we can use. The key to this particular mental construction is the differentiation of consciousness. And that is more than a model. There are such things as relatively differentiated and relatively undifferentiated consciousness. And so it's in that those terms that he sets up this model of stages of meaning. There's a first stage of meaning that follows the mode of more or less developed common sense. For a good part of our own lives, we were only in that stage of meaning. Down to, Piaget would say, probably down to at least the age of 12, most people are not capable of theoretical control of meaning. You might someday want to ask yourself, what is the first theoretical question that you ever raised in entertainment? And how old were you when you entertained it? Really theoretical question. But at least in Piaget's own, as I understand his thinking, we don't gain that kind of a monitoring of meaning until we are into late childhood, early adolescence. So we're in the common sense mode. Some people never move beyond it. That's okay. There's no moral judgment about that. But that is what he calls the first stage of meaning. It follows the mode of more or less developed common sense. A second stage adds theory controlled by a logic. And a third stage takes its stand on what Lonergan calls interiority. Individuals can go through, pass through all three stages. But history has passed through these in another way. The second stage in Western civilization comes into existence with the development of science and philosophy in Greece. When Socrates started to ask for universal definitions, definitions that applied only at soli, that applied to every instance of something and only to that. The beginning of a theoretically differentiated consciousness. What is justice? Everybody knew what it was because in a common sense way, and if they saw an unjust act or heard about it, they would say that's unjust. But to give a definition of it is another matter. And Socrates couldn't give a definition. But he's moving, he's opening up another field. Another sphere, another realm of meaning by asking that kind of question. And it's only, I think, with the turn to the subject in modern philosophy that in the West, at least, we have moved into interiority as a new field or a new realm of meaning and the ground of a new stage of meaning. In this third stage, which he would maintain is what we're in today, the principal concern shifts from meanings, contents, to the acts of meaning, operations. From products to sources, from objects to operations, and then on from there to a synthesis of operations and objects in a higher viewpoint. So it's moving from the contents to the operations that gave rise to the contents. So what insight conceived as a search for a common ground became a cumulative and progressive effort to articulate a normative source of meaning. Next equivalent up here. To articulate something like a normative source of meaning, a horizon, that those who have accepted the invitation that begins to be issued in insight might share. A horizon that is normative. The issue arises in a paper called Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, which again appears in the third collection, where Lonergan asks the question, do we have any way of ascertaining norms for collective responsibility? Norms for collective responsibility. What is normative? And his answer is going to be in terms of what he begins to unfold in this book. And normative not only for the individual, but for, again, this theme of common ground, community, for collective responsibility. So the major moments in his development are successive increments in clearing the common ground, in clearing that normative source of meaning. Insight is only the beginning, but everything else builds upon it. So that's placing the book in the context of his own development. Now I'm going to go on in a moment to say what is the common ground in insight, what does he add to it as he's proceeds. But let me stop for a moment and see that I'm not just flying in the clouds. Or do you understand what I'm talking about?
Just the normative source of meaning is a ground, is the ground of all three stages, right?
Yeah.
So when we have that equation up there, that the common ground is the ground of a stage, it should be the ground of all stages in the evolution of meaning.
And here it would be appropriating.
As the object.
In the third stage of meaning, you're appropriating the normative, so you're articulating. It's always functional.
Yes.
People have always raised the same kinds of questions. What is it? Is it so? What am I to do? That sort of thing. So it's always functioned, but what he's offering is an appropriation. But that's a good point. It's a clarification. It's always functioned.
Mm-hmm.
And any time that authenticity or genuineness has flourished, it's because it has functioned. You know. What he's calling us to is to articulate what it is.
Yeah.
The tacit, what Polanyi calls the tacit dimension, the dimension that's always been silent, but it's what makes scientists do what they do, it's what makes philosophers do what they do, and it is the unfolding of the questionable process. Or in common sense, it's, you know, the difference between a person of real common sense and a person that gets all befuddled and biased and everything else. Okay, so what is the common ground? Alright, first of all, as he conceived it in insight, and then as it moved. Okay, page 4 in this book. It is in insight that the common ground emerges not as a set of contents of intellectual act. We will never be able to have the kind of control that the Renaissance, so-called Renaissance man, had over what was available. I mean, even if that's probably too mystical. But in terms of contents, it's not possible. Not as a set of contents, but as a basic group of operations that constitute all human beings as human knowers. And the central operation is the one that he calls insight. So what he's asking you to do is to have a set of insights into insight. In the course of the book, we will be asked to recognize in our own experience at least the following kinds of insight. These things occur. I have these. And these are not all mutually exclusive. Some of them overlap, but I'm just listing the various features of insight that he will be pointing to. We'll start in chapter 1 with the direct insight that grasps intelligibility in the presentations of sense and imagination, whether in science in chapter 1 or in common sense, chapters 6 and 7. Direct insight, grasping intelligibility, grasping meaning in the presentations of sense and imagination. There's an inverse insight, which we'll see something of in chapter 1. That grasps that, in a sense, there is no intelligibility to be grasped where I thought there was. But I'm asking the wrong question. And if I keep going in this direction, I'm just not going to get anywhere. An inverse insight. There's what I call the identifying insight. The insight that discovers a unity identity whole in data. That's chapter 8 of the book. Unity identity whole. To which everything that pertains to that unity identity whole belongs. A person is an example of that. An identifying insight that this is a unity identity whole in data. Next, there's the reflective insight, chapter 10, that ascertains that the conditions for a prospective judgment have or have not been fulfilled. reflective insight. Next, there is, and this is also related to the others, but an introspective insight that grasps a structure in the data of consciousness. Chapter 11. The structure of experiencing, understanding, and judging. Next, there's basic set of philosophical insights, and by basic I'm putting here is not, that's not just rhetorical. These are the foundation of philosophic positions. The basic philosophic insights that articulate the structure of knowing, the meaning of being, and the elements of objectivity, chapters 11, 12, and 13. Knowing, being, and objectivity. Next, there's a whole set of metaphysical insights that work out the implications of a basic isomorphism, structure of identity of structure, between knowing and known, and that acknowledge that the truly known is being, and so the Greek being is intrinsically intelligible. The real is intelligible. There are genetic insights that specify the operators of development. There are dialectical insights that press for coherence between performance and concept, grasp contradiction, reverse what is incoherent. The basic positions on knowing, being, and objectivity. That's chapter 17. I should be giving you the chapters here. Back to metaphysical insights is 14 through 17. Genetic insights is 15, which is part of the metaphysics. Dialectical insights 17. Practical insights that size up situations and, when they're moral, grasp what possibly it would be good for one to do. We see those in chapters 6 and 7, and then again in 18. The limit insights that grasp one's own incapacity for sustained development on the basis of one's own resources, the end of chapter 18. That we're doomed unless there's something more in this world than what we've seen up to the end of chapter 18. And then the religious insights that discern the gift of a higher integration, chapters 19 and 20. And the theological insights that employ analogies to ground a few stuttering words about transcendent mystery. And the epilogue, and the whole work on the Trinity, and so on and so forth, which we're not going to get into in this course, but we'll head right into it. So as he will emphasize over and over again in all of this, the point is missed entirely if you concentrate exclusively on the content of the examples that he provides of these insights. He's providing content, the examples that he's familiar with, but he's asking you to find your own. The common ground of these insights is exclusively the fact that they're all insights. They're all acts of understanding. In the one subject, you, that common ground enables there to be derived an integration, not only of the knower, yourself as a knower, but also of what you know. You can bring an integration to the fragmentation of the knowledge by appropriating the fact that involved in all of it is insight. And in many subjects, that common ground enables a certain level and quality of communication and collaboration, of discourse ethics, if I may use Eugen Habermas's phrase, room raised, person to pay attention to, Jesuit, Centralist University, Rage, Habermas scholar, and I can point to anybody that's interested in this. He's got a couple of things on Habermas and Lonergan, and they're very good. One article in particular. The fact that we all have insights, and so that we all share the common dynamic that the early chapters of the book unfold, is, when affirmed, the basic and radical move onto this common ground, this strong ground, this ground of a new stage, this normative source of meaning. It's the basic and radical move. And the fact that we're asked not only to acknowledge that common ground, but also to appropriate it by relating insight to its antecedent conditions and its results in human knowing and living, marks that new and common ground as also a new plateau or a new stage of being. So focus in on insight in chapter one, but he'll want to relate that to its antecedents, which will be roughly sense and image, question. Insight. Emergent with the insight, some form of conceptualization. Further question, is it true, leading to judgment, leading to reflective insight and judgment? That's the basic structure that's unfolded in this book. Experience, understanding, judgment, bound together by two forms of question. Experience, question something like, what is it? What's going on? What's happening? Giving rise to insight. Further question, have I got it right? Is it true? Giving rise to judgment. Insight and conceptualization, question, giving rise to judgment. So we've got basic structure is experience, understanding, judgment. We'll come back to that and unpack it in many different ways. And it's still being unpacked in the Lonergan communities. New thoughts about each one of those levels. Bill Rage's work, for instance, has made a major contribution to the theory of judgment by bringing in the community. If you know anything about Habermas and the emphasis on community towards the formation of judgment, by bringing in the community as contributor to even the individual's judgments in a way that is more pronounced than in Lonergan's own writing. Some of the stuff is still being worked out, and there's a lot more to be done. As he himself said, all I've opened up is a structure. I think the structure, he said, is not subject to basic revision. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a lot more to be said about the elements in the structure.
Yes. Thomas's taken over from Aristotle, the two operations of the intellect?
It's Lonergan's interpretation of that, yes.
Okay.
I mean, not everybody agrees with that. Well, there's a reading of Thomas that is what Lonergan would call conceptualist. Conceptualist reading. And the conceptualist reading reverses the order between insight and conceptualization. And somehow, from a kind of intuition that occurs at the sense level, all right, there's an abstraction to concept. And then if there's any insight at all, the insight is into the interrelationship of concept.
Mm-hmm.
That's the conceptualist position. It's Dunscope's position, basically. But it has had a tremendous influence in the history, subsequent history of scholasticism. And it was only really reversed in Thomist scholarship in the 20th century, basically. To a certain extent, even by the Gilsonians, even though they didn't get insight, but at least they worked with the conceptualism. They had judgment back here. That's the only problem. It's a major problem. But it's people. Lonergan's the one that I think really discovered, presented the other interpretation most clearly. His interpretation of Thomas on this is in Verbum, which is volume 2 of the collected works. Verbum, : Word and Idea in Aquinas.
Mm-hmm.
And his insistence that in Aquinas, insight is the ground of conceptualization and not the other way around. That there's a radical relationship there. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't sometimes proceed the other way. I'm giving you a whole bunch of concepts. And if you're understanding the concepts that I'm presenting, then you're having insight into a whole bunch of concepts. But where are your original insights? And what are they into? Your original insights are into the concatenation of experiences that you put together through the creativity of your own imagination. And that's how it moves on. And that's how new concepts emerge. New concepts emerge from new insights. And it takes sometimes a while for the new concepts to find the formulation that really matches the insight, if the insight is really original. But that is not into just a bunch of concepts, that insight. It's into the configuration of the imaginative construction of experience. And that's, so his position, he's not denying that there's some truth to what the conceptualists are saying, that sometimes obviously we do work that way. But that they can't account for development and creativity. You know? And concepts, there's no way of accounting in the conceptualist position for how concepts can change. We'll see more next. Yes, right.
Could you explain this? Is it proper to see in this the phrases, the phantasm, the inner word, and second inner word?
Right, you got right there. Phantasm is right back here. First inner word, conceptualization. Judgment. Yes or no?
Okay, so judgment would be second.
Emerges from reflective understanding. When you grasp that the conditions for a prospective judgment are fulfilled, when you grasp that by an intellectual necessity, yes, emerges in your interiority. You've made a leap to a new, whatever you want to call it, level or whatever. And you don't even have to speak the judgment, but you're no longer thinking, you're affirming. And that's a different operation. But you're affirming because you have grasped that there are no further questions on this particular issue, if you've grasped that. Now, you can be rash, you can be jumping to conclusions, and all that sort of thing. There's a whole matter of monitoring, self-monitoring that has to go on there. But at the same time, there are occasions on which we grasp that there are no further questions on a given issue. We have, the example that he gives us so often is you go out, you leave your house in the morning, and it's tidy and everything else, and you come home and there's smoke in the air, and the windows are smashed, and there's water all over the floor, and you say, something happened. The evidence is sufficient. For that judgment, you might have to go on and say, what happened? There might be other questions to raise, but that something happened. If the evidence is in, you can make that judgment. And there are others. There are the basic philosophic judgment on the structure of experience, understanding, and judgment. He will maintain, and I think pretty strongly, that it's an irreversible judgment. That structure is can't be done. But the judgment is the second inner word. It emerges when you grasp, from a reflective insight, when you grasp inner reflective active understanding, that the conditions for the judgment have been fulfilled. And that there's no sense in raising any further questions. You're just wasting your time. It's conventional. So, that's it. But the first inner word is conceptualization, it's hypothesis, for instance, the scientist raises the questions about whatever it is that he's examining, and they have an insight that comes up with a particular hypothesis. The hypothesis is the first thing
that
would
be science, the quidsit.
The quidsit.
And the second is the onset. Affirmation onset.
A quidsit of what is it, and onset is it something.
Let's go a little further here.
Okay, so this insight into insight, we are asked, the fact that we're asked not only to acknowledge that common ground, but also to appropriate it by relating insight to its antecedent conditions. Okay, this insight into insight is also an owning of who one is. So it's a very, as he'll say in the preface, I'm inviting you to a very personal act. each one has to do it on his or her own. It is an appropriation. It is a claim upon a natural right that no one can take away from them. And furthermore, it's the acknowledgement of the task, the responsibility, an imperative or a sentiment. The natural law for Lonergan is articulated in terms of the levels of consciousness. Be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable, be responsive. There is an imperative connected with each of those. We'll see more of that too. All of these different types of insight occur in a common field named consciousness or self-presence. The subject as subject. This field can never be fully objectified, because the human subject doing the objectifying is always and inescapably beyond the subject as objectified. The subject as subject will never coincide completely with the subject as object. I can't turn around and get the ouroboros swallowing this table and get a hold of the whole thing, because the subject as subject is always a step ahead. The subject is object. And I think, this is a real hypothesis here, but I think that difference, or difference, if you want, between subject and subject and subject and object is at the source of the deconstructive efforts of Derrida, and especially his notion of the trace. I may be wrong here, but that's the way I'm reading. And that's not to say that Lonergan and Derrida draw the same conclusions from that difference, far from it. But at least to this extent, they're acknowledging something similar. No less than Derrida, Lonergan does not acknowledge a turn to the subject that would be the turn to the subject as an object of some controlling inner look. And I suspect that the difference between Derrida and Lonergan is that for Lonergan, the field in which the turn occurs, consciousness, is not perception. It's not representation. It's not knowledge except in the limited sense of awareness, self-presence. And that Derrida might not be clear on this. He might be interpreting consciousness as representation and perception. That's a hypothesis, but it's an interesting question anyway. At any rate, for Lonergan, the field is the field of the awareness of self, the field of the self-taste, if you want, that accompanies all conscious act. And states. The objectification of that, of it, that is possible, can occur only through a humbling and purifying heightening of awareness itself. A heightening that enables not only an attending to and insight into the relations of the successive operations and states that occur in the unfolding of conscious dynamism, but also, and we'll see this in chapter 11, a personal judgment. This is what I am. And a decision to be faithful to. Insight discloses other operations besides those of experience and understanding. I've been through this and with the diagram, but the link between those two levels of consciousness is the question for intelligence. What, why, how often, and so on. The insight itself is productive of the inner word or set of concepts that, when formulated in language, prompts a further question, this time for critical reflection, is it so? This question is satisfied by the reflective insight that grasps that the conditions for a judgment are or are not fulfilled, grounds the inner word of yes or no, and so results in judgment. And holding the entire process together is the desire to know, which is reflected in these different questions. The desire to know. But I won't be satisfied. I'm really not satisfied. I don't stop asking questions until I reach the point where, on a given point, there are no further questions to be asked. And I know that. Otherwise, I keep raising until I get there. So it's never satisfied on any issue until the yes or no of reasonable judgment is reached. While it then resumes the process by turning to other questions, its governance of conscious performance can also be blocked by bias of different kinds. There's a desire to know, but there's also a flight from understanding. And as Sebastian Noor once said, sometimes it's a rocket flight from understanding. And so Lonergan's uncovering of the various forms of bias is yet a further disclosure of the common ground. That's also part of what we have in common, this tendency to bias, but this time the darker elements of the common goal. Okay, that's enough for a first stab. We'll take a break for about 10 minutes and we'll come back. We'll go on to what else he does in Insight and then some of the things that came up in his story. Enough for sufficient for the day.
Thank you.